It's a piece of Seeds of Terror that we'll highlight again here coming up in just a second. Just how much is the Taliban and Al-Qaeda like these international organizations that make all of their money in blood and crime? That these are groups that are dedicated to making a profit first and then living up to their ideals second. That's a far cry from what they sell the rest of the world as the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, as these fundamentalist groups that are all about the following the letter of the law of Islam. Couldn't be further from the truth, as we're talking tonight with Gretchen Peters next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. You know, we were talking about the similarities between the mafia and the Taliban before with Gretchen Peters. And Gretchen, it occurred to me, too, there was something else that struck me about the origin of the story of the Taliban as you told it. And that is, that's just like how the mafia gains power originally in Sicily, right? It's in the
exactly. vacuum
of power.
The mafia started out as anti-state group, just like the Taliban. So did the Yakuza in Japan. So did many of the triads in China.
Did the Ku Klux Klan in this country.
Right, exactly. I mean, and I think that's, in a way, what's so alarming about this is that when insurgent groups turn into criminal groups, when they morph into criminal groups, they become much harder to get rid of permanently. And so that means the Mullah Omar of today is the Tony Soprano of tomorrow.
Yeah. So, all right. So, again, we were kind of focused on the Taliban. Let's talk a little bit about Al-Qaeda as it relates to the poppy production and the sale of opium and heroin around the world.
Well, this is, a really interesting case, in particular because the way U.S. officials have spoken about it has done so many flip-flops over the past 10 years, and even there seem to be disputing statements out of government agencies throughout the time when I was first reporting this. And basically what happened is I had worked in the region prior to the 2001 attacks, and then was hired almost immediately after 2001 as a freelance contractor by ABC News to go to take their teams or to run some of their operations back in the region. And in about 2003, right about the time that the U.S. was invading Iraq, we were preparing for that war, I started hearing from people in southern Afghanistan that the poppy crop. Well, everybody knew that the poppy crop was growing a lot, but I was starting to hear that the Taliban and other extremist groups in the border areas were profiting off it, and they were coming. They were going to come back. They were going to make a resurgence with the money they earned from the drugs trade. And so I started asking around about it, and there were a few very helpful officials frustrated by the Bush administration, frustrated by the fact that everybody else was denying it. But by and large, I was told I was crazy, that I didn't know what I was talking about, that there was no evidence to prove that the Taliban or Al-Qaeda was involved, that there was only fragmentary information about Al-Qaeda's involvement in the drugs trade. And that kind of ticked me off, because there was the more I looked around, the evidence was everywhere.
Right.
I mean, just the fact that there was this, they were based in the same region as the world's largest poppy crop. That's not a coincidence. I mean, just for starters. But I mean, once I started looking through government archives and going through the history books and interviewing people in the region, there were clear links. And what I have found in my research is that it's very clear that today low-level operatives within Al-Qaeda help move drug shipments out of Afghanistan. Once they reach the Taliban and other local insurgent groups or other local insurgent branches of the Taliban will control the drug trade to Afghanistan's borders, and that's where they profit off it. But that's where their influence stops. And they don't really have any intentions outside of Afghanistan politically either. That's when Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups that operate in the region, the most powerful among them or the most deeply involved is a group called the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan that we don't hear about much here in the United States because they don't have any. They want to attack Uzbekistan. They don't want to attack our country. But they're very deeply involved in the heroin trade, and their fighters were considered to be Osama bin Laden's bodyguards for years along the border. So there are very close links between smugglers and al-Qaeda. And from my research, I found that U.S. and British intelligence agents who were watching al-Qaeda believed that bin Laden was a big facilitator of the drugs trade while the Taliban were in power. Many believed that he hijacked, essentially hijacked Afghanistan's national airlines, Ariana Airlines, and used those planes to move men, to move material, and to also to move drugs. And there's quite a lot of evidence for this. There's evidence also, there's a terrific book, I don't know if you've ever had this author on your show, but there's a terrific book by an author named Doug Farah, two authors, Stephen Braun and Doug Farah, about a Russian smuggler named Victor Boot, who was really behind a lot of the gun running and other smuggling.
I know him from your book, right?
Yeah, it's global cargo smuggling. It's a hugely interesting story. And Victor Boot, this Russian smuggler, who had not, you know, clearly no link to Islam or any ideological beliefs. This guy is a criminal of the first degree. He became involved in helping them smuggle all sorts of stuff, and many believe. Smuggle drugs. Many officials believe he was helping the Taliban and al-Qaeda smuggle drugs, although he hasn't been convicted of that, so that's just an accusation at this point.
Sure.
And so you had this whole dirty circle of players who, again, as you keep repeating, Ian, and I keep arguing, these guys hardly look like pious Muslims.
Yeah. That whole image of the self-sacrificing soldier saint, I think that it seems to be for suckers in the sense that they're not interested in giving up their own lives. They're not interested in putting themselves out there to be either captured or to sacrifice themselves for Allah. They want other people to do it, too. And I think that parallels kind of the same attitude that they take toward drugs. You know, it's they're not going to do it, so that makes it okay, you know, for them to make the money off it. They're not interested in, you know, why should they have to live this ascetic life? You know, they're as you put in the cover of the book, these aren't guys who are living in caves. These guys have a pretty good deal going on,
right? I mean, I think the foot soldiers, the foot soldiers of the Taliban, they are. You know, this image we have of the filthy fanatic living in a cave, carrying a Kalashnikov, illiterate, you know, not fairly ignorant of the outside world. That is an accurate portrayal of your average Taliban foot soldier. But that person has been co-opted by this propaganda. He believes what he's fighting for. But I think he could be pulled away from them if he saw. What was really behind
sure.
them. The criminal forces behind them are not guys living in caves, believe you me. They are very wealthy. They don't live in Afghanistan. And they are probably some of the world's most powerful and shadowy businessmen.
Well, and couldn't that be one of the reasons why we haven't had another terrorist attack? That this really has gotten to be such a... This is a big part of what's on their plate. I mean, if they... To keep all of these operations running, to keep the shipments going, to keep, I mean, the between all that they have in order to make that happen and then actually to get it done, I don't know, it seems to me that would take a lot of your work week.
Well, you know, that's an interesting idea. I think violence is certainly spreading in that region, and they've kept the U.S. military pretty pinned down in Iraq. Until we, you know, might be pulling out of that now. We're very much pinned down in Afghanistan. If you listen to statements that Osama bin Laden has made, and I always argue that the best way to know what al-Qaeda is planning is to listen to what they tell you, because they usually tell you what they're planning. They certainly say that their intention is to get their hands on weapons of mass destruction. And lots of experts say that it will be very hard for al-Qaeda to technologically pull off a nuclear attack, use a dirty bomb against us. But one thing that would make it a lot easier is having lots and lots of money. And so that, to me, is what is concerning about this. And
right.
also just, I mean, the government now is talking about implementing a counterinsurgency campaign in Afghanistan, as we have done in Iraq. And the two most critical elements of any counterinsurgency campaign, according to all the experts, people like David Kilcullen and others, is denying him his support, denying the insurgent the support he needs from the public, and cutting off the enemy's ability to fund himself, degrading his ability to fund himself.
Well, and so let's go back and amplify that, though, a little bit. You know, they're not in a position, the Taliban or al-Qaeda, perhaps, to be able to create a bomb of their a weapon of mass destruction of their own.
Well, they're getting closer in Pakistan, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. But I'm saying when you've got that much money, if they've bankrolled that much money, how hard will it be, or how long would it be before they'd be able to just turn around and write a check for one?
Well, I couldn't really predict, but the Pakistani Taliban is advancing rapidly. I think what the most alarming thing going on in the world right now is the rapid advance of the Taliban in Pakistan across that country. And I'd like to make another point in all of this. I have researched the how drugs and criminal activity support the insurgents and extremist groups in this border area. But it's also important to know that criminal activity and the drugs trade has supported corrupt officials, both in the governments of Afghanistan and in Pakistan. And that has created a sort of perverse, what I call a perverse incentive for them to create a stable region, for them to make Afghanistan and Pakistan better places to live. So what we see now happening in Pakistan is the government is just crumbling, and the Taliban are advancing across this nuclear-armed nation, that was the greatest nuclear proliferator in the history of the world. So if there's ever a place where it's dangerous to have a bunch of extremists with a whole lot of money who want to buy nukes, you know, I think it's Pakistan.
It's going to be Pakistan. If you had to make a prediction based on what you know and what you think about these the histories of these groups and the people with whom you've associated over the years, what do you think might be their next move if they were going to get their hands on a nuke? What might happen?
Well, I don't think al-Qaeda would hesitate to use a nuke if they could get their hands on one. Whether they could actually pull off deploying one is a completely different question. I think what U.S. officials and other security officials around the world are worried about is that there's just this widening amount of ungoverned territory that now spans the two border areas. You know, they often talk about in Colombia this Switzerland-sized territory that was controlled by the FARC. And you have a situation very much like that, that actually straddles the border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's probably bigger than Switzerland at this point. I haven't actually compared the land area they control, but you have this huge amount of ungoverned territory. There's corruption. There might be some signs of the state. I mean, you can go to a place like Peshawar or Quetta in Pakistan, and they still collect garbage, and the airports still work, and the phone system still works. But criminals can operate with impunity. It's basically ungoverned.
Right.
It's basically ungoverned space. And places like that are magnets for extremists, for criminals, for organized crime, for money laundering, for people trafficking, all of that stuff. And the fact that all of these people have come together, all of these criminal groups, international organized crime, and extremist groups that have repeatedly expressed their determination to attack our country and the West, I just think it's an incredibly dangerous situation because they're interacting in ways that they never have before.
Well, do you think that their first move would be to fulfill the promise they have to wipe Israel off the map?
I think that comes more from Iran than it does come from those crowds. I think at this point, I think Israel would be a target if they could get their hands on weapons of mass destruction. I think the U.S., the U.K., and all of the countries in NATO would be targets. And one thing I'd like to point out, there have been some really creepy reports in the last couple of weeks filtering out of Afghanistan, and I think three or four of them now, of girls' schools some kind of poison gas has been released into these schools. And no girls have died yet in any of these attacks, but about a dozen have become ill and had to be hospitalized. And what that's the result of that is that lots of parents are not sending their girls to school anymore in Afghanistan. There have been a horrible string of attacks on girls' schools, which has really reduced women's education levels, which had actually recovered quite a bit since the Taliban were tossed out of power. But what's concerning to me as well is that somebody has gotten their hands on some kind of chemical weapon out there, and they're using it locally right now, but they may just be testing it. And
right,
to me, that's concerning.
Right. That's a what do they call that in test of concept?
Yeah, concept test. And yeah. This has happened before. I was in Pakistan when there was an attempted bombing of the U.S. consulate in Karachi, the southern port city of Karachi, and that had a chemical element to it. They had attached explosives to a tank of some sort of gas that would have made everybody sick in the area. And there was also an attempt in Jordan to use a chemical bomb, and there was a chemical component to, do you remember that alleged attack on the guys that they arrested who they thought were planning to set off explosives at Heathrow?
Right.
A chemical component to that plot as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've repeatedly stated their intention to do this, and there are signs that they're trying. I remember we came across, when I first worked for ABC and we went into Kabul after the Taliban fell with the first wave of troops that went in there, and everybody was searching these old al-Qaeda hideouts because everybody wanted I think it was the Wall Street Journal that came across this laptop that was just this treasure trove of stories, and it had been a senior al-Qaeda member's laptop and contained correspondence between Osama bin Laden and his number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri. It was this treasure trove, and so all of our editors were like, go out and find something like that so we have an exclusive too.
Right.
And we found this video of this guy. It was so creepy. I will never forget this video of this guy with a gas mask on, and they were gassing this little puppy. They were doing this test to see how to to releasing gas from this canister. It was like something you'd see on 24. I couldn't believe it.
Right. Well, and then let's talk about what the U.S. is doing then currently to try to cut off the supply of drug money to the Taliban or to al-Qaeda. That's part of our efforts, our military efforts in Afghanistan. I guess you had some news of some recent success that that the U.S. has had, and maybe that's just we need to focus on a little bit of hope that we might be able to drive a wedge in there. And we'll get to that coming up next with Gretchen Peters, author of Seeds of Terror. We're about 30 minutes away or so from you being able to ask a question, but we'll open up the phones for the last hour about how specifically how heroin, how drug trafficking is driving the al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and how much of their organizations are really like organized crime. Now, also, I want to get back to something that Gretchen said in the first hour. What are some of the other things they're trafficking in other than drugs? That's coming to light. She said a lot of it came out after her book was already set to go to press. We'll get to that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. When you consider how addictive heroin really is and how much of the world is addicted to it, how much more of that addiction is growing in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and how the Taliban and al-Qaeda are all behind it. Now, they're the ones getting the big profit from it, out of the poppies out of Afghanistan. So what are we doing? How can the U.S. possibly fight that? We'll get to that coming up next, and some recent successes to give us hope. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Gretchen Peters, Seeds of Terror. So the Taliban, you know, we know that we're locked horns with the Taliban and we're fighting them directly in Afghanistan and indirectly through Pakistan. And the drug money is the football that's kind of in between all these things, these poppy fields. Recently, we were able to sort of take over a region or something. Is that how it worked?
That the Taliban will take over the region?
No, that we did. We were able to fight the insurgents and we captured like 60 of them or something.
Yes. There was a tremendous success against the Taliban today in a district called Marja in Helmand province. That's an area that profits the trafficking group of the largest trafficking group in the area. NATO forces fighting there killed as many as 60 rebels in the attack, and they overran the town, and they made the largest drug haul in, I believe, in world history, 92 tons of drugs, heroin, processing chemicals, and also bomb-making materials. An astounding drug cache.
Now, did you have to notice whether, do we burn it? What do we do with that?
The drugs will be destroyed. Normally, I mean, to destroy a drug stash of that size is going to take a very long time.
Wow.
But normally, when they recover these stockpiles, and the Taliban keep stockpiles. And I'd like to add that so do, it's not clear that the Taliban and the other insurgents groups are actually making more money in the region than anybody else. A lot of people believe that corrupt officials in the governments of Pakistan and Afghanistan are making possibly even more money. And there are some very, very senior officials who have been linked to the trade, most notably the brother of President Hamid Karzai. And so when I talk about this situation, and I've just been in Washington for a week giving briefings to officials and think tanks and that kind of thing, they are actually listening. For years, I was ignored. I was this sort of struggling freelancer, totally ignored by
mother of two out there trying to get
ignored by the establishment on this issue. And now they're paying attention to what I have to say, and I think they'll pay more attention after today's 92. Ton drug haul. Our biggest challenge out there is not that we're fighting an enemy that is deeply involved in criminality. Our challenge is actually that our so-called allies in the region are so deeply involved. I mean, that's the biggest problem we have out there. I mean, I studied how it supports the insurgencies. That's what I focused on. And I've had some angry comments on my website and stuff that my reports are from academics saying my reporting is enemy-centric and that I have to pay attention to the corruption. Well, I absolutely pay attention to the corruption issues. It's our biggest problem out there, I think.
And so these are the people that we're giving money to, and they're also making money.
Lots of money. We're giving
lots
them
of
lots
money
of
on
money,
the side.
And they're possibly making more money than the Taliban even. And I estimate that the Taliban alone are earning $500 million every year off the drugs trade.
Is it winnable? Is the war in Afghanistan winnable?
Well, I believe that we could easily, not easily, nothing out there will be easy. But I think if we implement a counterinsurgency strategy similar to what was done in Iraq, and I do think that the current military administration and government in Washington basically gets this. I mean, I think they basically understand what they need to do out there. The problem is actually how we're going to pay for it, for one thing. I mean, it's going to be expensive, and it's extremely complex, and we're dealing with an enemy that's very fluid, and we are coming from a bureaucracy that's very it's not so fluid, that's slow-moving, slow to react, and where everybody has responsibility for something You know, the DEA does counter-narcotics, the FBI does law enforcement, the military fights the insurgency. It doesn't work that way among the enemy. They're all working together.
Right.
And so one of the things that I've been arguing in these, in some of these presentations I've done in think tanks and in Washington is that, you know, we need to reshape our strategy to be a lot more fluid the way they are.
Well, we could always take the drugs we confiscate and then sell it on the street, use that money to... No, I'm kidding. But that's the kind of circular logic that the other people have
used.
Well,
a lot of people, I would also say that a lot of people who've been writing into me and asking me questions say, well, why don't we just legalize it? I personally support a lot of ideas about legalization of drugs, particularly, I mean, I live in a state now that where medical marijuana is legal, and, you know, proponents of that, I actually recently went and did a story about this and visited a medical marijuana clinic where there were people. I interviewed one woman who had a range of illnesses, and she was taking 19 pills every day. And by taking medical marijuana, she had gotten herself down to just two.
Right.
And a lot of people who are proponents of it believe, and here's another conspiracy for you, believe that the drug companies prevent people from getting access to it or prevent keep it illegal because you can't put a patent on marijuana.
Right.
So any local sort of marijuana pharmacy would be able to create all sorts of natural products that would cure everything from pain to eczema. Anyway, that's what they argue. And so, and I actually think that's a pretty persuasive argument. And there's a idea floating around that California, for example, could pull itself out of its current economic problems simply by legalizing marijuana for recreational use as well as medical. I wouldn't specifically argue that we should legalize heroin. I think that's a very dangerous and addictive, highly addictive drug. But
right.
The problem with the proposals to legalize Afghanistan's crop or just buy it, and people suggest that we could buy it and put it into pharmaceuticals. But none of these plans are really viable because there's no way to monitor there's no way to regulate what's going on out there.
Right.
I mean, if we legalized America's marijuana crop, we could regulate it the way we regulate other farm products. And I mean, we have a functioning government and a functioning law enforcement here. In Afghanistan, there's nothing like that. Besides, the drugs don't come here. I think the most persuasive argument I hear against the legalization suggestions that I often get from readers of my book, people who see my website, is that, you know, sure, let's legalize it. Go ask the governments of Pakistan, Iran, Kazakhstan, Russia, China, the places where Afghanistan's drugs are ending up. Go ask them what they think about that plan. And you're going to find a bunch of countries that are struggling with skyrocketing addiction rates.
Right.
They're not going to let that happen.
Overwhelmed. So what else are these groups trafficking in? I know you mentioned at the very beginning that, you know, when your book went to press, you were focused on the drugs, but you're finding out more and more that and how much of it is the Taliban and Al-Qaeda that really are trafficking in more than just illegal drugs?
Right. Well, that's a great question. And there are a lot of different groups operating in the region. So I just want to really briefly and as simply as possible explain it. You have your local insurgent groups. And in a lot of cases, these are just like basically now they're just criminal gangs. And their area of operation is just often just a few districts along the border. And they don't really have any intention. It's basically like your local mafia guy who works over the local community. He might extort local businesses. He might be running guns. He might be doing a little bit of human trafficking. There's a lot of kidnapping gangs. There's a huge amount of antiquities smuggled. I mean, Afghanistan is at the center of the old Silk Route, and everybody from Genghis Khan to Alexander the Great to the ancient Buddhists have come across Afghanistan, and it actually has this fascinating ancient history and fascinating ancient sites. These ancient sites are being plundered, and again, insurgents are helping to smuggle antiquities out of the region. You also have some regional extremist groups, Pakistani groups that want to attack Kashmir, the divided Himalayan state that both India and Pakistan claim. You have Chechen groups who have come who have rebased themselves there, or the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, which got driven out of Uzbekistan and now is actually in Pakistan. There's tons of these groups, and they're getting involved in all sorts of stuff. But I would say the main growth industries these days are kidnapping, human trafficking, and gun running, but also extorting local businesses. We recently heard, for example, that the Taliban, who've just taken over the Valley of Swat in Pakistan, the Pakistani Taliban, they've taken over emerald mines in that valley, and they've started selling gemstones on the black market. So everywhere they move into, and this is just something I heard in the last couple of weeks, the story about the emerald mines, everywhere they move into, similar to the mafia or any criminal group, they just immediately start working on how they'll make money.
Well, I'm a little worried about the gemstone too, just because theoretically, I mean, there's a lot of things they could do to flood other people's markets and ruin the value, see the value drop out in other trades too. I mean, it depends on how insidious they're going to be about this, but they seem to have their fingers on a lot of different buttons.
I hadn't realized.
Yeah. It's
a diversifying criminal empire. That's what I call it.
Where do the humans end up? Where do the human trafficking? Where do they go?
Yeah, similar to any poor, impoverished region, you have a lot of people who go to work somewhere else. You get into almost any taxi in a place like Dubai, and it's driven by a young Pakistani man from the tribal areas, usually, because there's no work up there.
Right.
I often say that they either join the insurgency or they leave. I often say that Taliban is just another word for unemployed young man. I mean, part of the problem, and this is what I see as our only exit strategy, is to provide development, provide alternative jobs, alternative livelihoods to either joining criminal activity or joining the insurgency. But anyway, it's interesting regarding human trafficking, because traditionally it's been just smuggling some person to another part of the world where they can find work, either the UK or Europe or the Middle East or somewhere else in South Asia. But increasingly I hear reports that these people that they send towards the West usually they'll have their belly full of heroin pellets. They'll be carrying, they'll be smuggling drugs. So you see these groups merging increasingly, and again, that's a very dangerous situation.
You think we're getting to a point where we're going to have a more eyes wide open as opposed to eyes wide shut policy in the future, that you're seeing that there's a change in this, and we actually are seeing the region more for what it is?
Yes. I think there's a real recognition that they have to, that it's finally time to get serious about this, both within our military and within the new administration. And I think that, I'm not suggesting they're not going to make any mistakes, but I do think they get it, what's going on. And I have heard, although I do think this will take time to see any results, but I've heard that there is increased cooperation among government agencies that have traditionally not cooperated very well, specifically the DEA and the military, or the DEA and the CIA,
right.
That they're trying to share information a little bit better. And, you know, it was a lack of information sharing that led to 9/11. That was why they didn't pick up on the fact that these guys were in the country.
In light of how powerful the weapons are in Pakistan, should we be dropping everything in Iraq and Afghanistan and going into Pakistan to stabilize Pakistan and to prevent the Taliban from getting their hands on weapons of mass destruction?
Well, no, I don't think so. For one thing, I'm pretty alarmed about how we're going to deal with Pakistan. I think that's a really worrisome situation, and it really needs to be stabilized quickly, as in within months, not years.
Right.
I certainly don't think the U.S. should invade another Muslim country. That would just be a public relations disaster. And it's not like we can just, we still have like 100,000 troops, and I don't even know the current number, but we still have a huge number of troops in Iraq. Just because we don't hear about it in the media is not because it's not happening. It's because most of the mainstream media just ignores the story now. But and focuses on the economic problems, et cetera, which are also important. But we still have a lot of troops over there. You can't just snap your fingers and move them out.
Right.
But I really think our and again, this is your basic counterinsurgency policy, but any counterinsurgency expert would say, and I don't count myself as one, but the best weapons don't shoot. I mean, if we can go into these areas and support development, more schools, the question is whether we can do it fast enough. And that's what I worry about in Pakistan. It's disintegrating at such a pace that at this point, I think with all of those troops that we're sending into Afghanistan, we can help stabilize some of these southern areas and send in aid. Again, I like to talk about this misperception that people have in the West, that the people in the border areas, the Afghan and Pakistani people, are fanatics, that they're all corrupt, that they're all criminals. They're not. I mean, I've worked in that area for a decade, and people often ask me how I was treated, how I was received. And I always say, you know, I was treated like a queen. I always had the best seat in the car, the best room in the hut. People opened their homes to me and their hearts and shared information. And I think it's one of the friendliest places in the world. It's just been overtaken by, in three decades of war, it's become this magnet for extremists and criminals. And that happens anywhere, anytime there's lack of governance, anytime there's war, anytime there's instability. You can see it over and over again in the Middle East, in Colombia, anywhere around the world where in the Balkans, this happens. And I think if we started helping the people out there get what they want, and it's not much different from what we want. You know, the last election was decided in part on people's desire for better health care, for education reform, for more job security. That's all they want out there. Same as us.
Okay, and as we wrap things up here and we get ready for questions coming up in our final hour with Gretchen Peters, again, the book is Seeds of Terror. Is there any evidence of anything that you've come across with our intelligence people, with our CIA, who are playing either both ends to the middle or playing both sides on this, as has happened, and we know now, as has happened in the past with the CIA and drugs?
Right, like in places like Laos and Nicaragua.
Yeah.
Well, there's certainly a lot of theories about that, and I talk about that in the book, in particular in Chapter 2, theories that not only did CIA agents at the time know about, I mean, they certainly knew that members of the Muj were smuggling drugs, but actually there were some indications that through our partners in the ISI, who are also the ISI is Pakistan's drug agents, spy agency, who many believe that the ISI is deeply corrupted by the drugs trade. There's some speculation that senior CIA officials actively encouraged the Muj to traffic in drugs to try and make addicts of the Soviet soldiers. And that certainly was a result of the war.
Right.
Russia had a terrible addiction problem.
And that, as you write in the book, some people denied that that was the strategy, but it was the outcome. So it seemed like if it wasn't the strategy, how did it end up being the outcome after all? I mean, well, good. That's a great time to take a break then. And let's go to the phones with Gretchen Peters, the author of Seeds of Terror. And it's such a new thing for a lot of folks to think about these groups as really being just like the mafia in this country. That, yes, there is still a fanatic component to them. There are some people who will still be the terrorists as we understand them, but that the overall flavor of these organizations are much more like organized criminal groups like we have here in the United States. Back for Seeds of Terror about the Taliban and Al-Qaeda next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.